On the 19th and 20th of July, Lug Radio brings you the coolest conference of the year with over 30 speakers and exhibitors from around the world.
Chris DeBona,
Max Spivak,
KDE,
Steve Lamb,
Matthew Garrett,
Bite Mark,
James Hooker,
Kevin Sandon,
Viculus,
RB,
Ubuntu UK,
Daniel James,
Emma Jane Hopkin,
Open Rights Group,
Bruno Board,
Ben Thorpe,
Rufus Pollock,
Minutes Outlaws,
Sam Birchall,
John Carr,
Christine Scheller,
Edward Harvey,
64 Studios,
William J. Giddens,
Rob McQueen,
Agostino Russo,
Minutes and Corey,
Robert Cohen,
Chris Hayes,
Benjamin Elton,
William Anderson,
Matthew Wilson.
Lug Radio Live, UK 2008.
The Lighthouse Media Centre in Wolverhampton, England. Entrance is just £5 for both days. International visitors getting free.
Lugradio.org/live.
Okay, welcome back to another edition of the Fresh Ubuntu Podcast. This is Harlem, and I'm here with Peter Nicolaitis. How you doing, buddy?
Woohoo!
Sound pretty excited. So that must mean that you're, number one, in a good mood, and number two, you have your learner's permit or working permit for your motorcycle thing.
No, not yet. I got to take the test tomorrow morning.
Okay. You tweeted me, and you said something about being in a good mood, blah, 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 blah.
It's a really nice day, and that freaking heat wave that we had for the last 3 days is finally broken.
Oh.
So it'll be nice to kind of maybe get out on my bike tonight and, you know, not sweat off 5 pounds before I get down the driveway. Not that that's a bad thing. It's just, you know, I prefer to take a slightly more gradual
pace.
How hot
has it been over there?
It was close. It was in the mid to high 80s, which, you know, overall is not, it, you know, it's certainly gotten a lot hotter here, but it was quite sudden and very, very hot and humid. So it was kind of hard to take.
Sorry to hear that, but now it's at a more reasonable level, right? Good.
Yeah. We're hanging in there.
Well, it could be the weather like around here. I mean, it's been raining the past week or so, and today is actually the first day in a few weeks where we've gotten any sun. So, you know, it looks to be about 70 around here in these parts of the woods. So anyway,
cool.
So you ready for this week's podcast?
I sure hope so. What are we going to do if I say no?
We'll wing it like we do every week. So. Well, we have an interview this week with Brian Murray. He is the Bug Master, and will be interesting to see how he got that name. Also, a Man Page Minute this weekend. And up next, we have some news. So we'll be back shortly with the news. Okay, we're back with the news here. Well, Peter, it is time that we get this thing going and start with the news. So why don't we start off with our first story of the day, is that someone has hacked presidential nominee Barack Obama's website. And now he's looking for a new network security expert to help lock down their website after it was hacked. Apparently it happened a couple of months ago. And they're really, I would be pretty upset if I were running for president and someone hacked my website. It should be on the top of everyone's list. Anyone running for office or anyone, period, should think about network security. The website was built by Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes and has been a model of Web 2.0 campaigning and using social networking techniques to raise funds and build a broad case of active internet savvy supporters. What do you think, Peter?
I think that, you know, the presidential candidate's website is definitely high enough priority that he should have a security guy there maintaining it, or gal, as the case may be. But I thought it was kind of funny. One quote of the article said that the person who gets that position should plan on getting a new job come
November. I saw that, too. You won't be around much long, you know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, presumably if that person does well and if Obama does win, that perhaps you'd get another new job in January. Well, but who knows? That's usually the way these things work.
Right.
So if any of us are masters of uncomplicated firewall, go ahead and apply for the job.
And we are. Do we do?
Because I'm sure that's all it takes.
All right, that's right. And that we'll have a news report about that coming up real soon. But we have tried to stay apolitical here on Fresh Ubuntu, and this really has nothing to do whatsoever. It's neither support or not support any one of the candidates for that matter. But we're just announcing this because we might be able to help. So anyway, let's go on to the next news item we have. We have this is from Australian PC World, and they have a desktop Linux face-off between Ubuntu 8.04 and Fedora 9. Now, I don't know who won or who lost, and they try to keep it a little bit ambiguous anyway.
It's not terribly clear, but Ubuntu seems to edge out over Fedora just slightly.
And I'd have go ahead.
Yeah, there's nothing major hands down Ubuntu wins or anything like that. So
these magazines are afraid to take a side. So
Yeah, well, we're not.
But you have had some experience with Fedora, right?
Yeah, just recently I was trying to do an upgrade on my CentOS box, technically not Fedora, but still a RPM-based application. And I did a yum update, and it failed because it couldn't resolve the dependencies. I'm sorry, I wasn't going to say anything about it, but, it's just, it makes me laugh and cry at the same time.
Stay away from that RPM hell now.
Yeah, I know. This is what we would call a legacy system. So, we're stuck with it right now.
Well, cool.
So,
anyone wanting to find out the results of the desktop Linux face-off, we'll put the link in the show notes, between Ubuntu 8.04 and Fedora 9. Next up on the list is the introduction of the uncomplicated firewall GUI for Ubuntu Linux Hardy Heron. Now, you really love this particular feature of Hardy Heron.
Yeah, I like it. And I think it's kind of funny because now there's a GUI, the GUFW, which I dub the official Fresh Ubuntu pronunciation to be guffaw. And guffaw there. It's pretty much a really, really simple firewall. If you've used another GUI tool like Firestarter or a web-based interface to IP tables, this one's pretty simple. It's kind of funny, though. It's basically, on, off, allow from this, this address. It really does look like a front end to UFW. So not super powerful, but fairly intuitive. So looks, if you like the idea of really, 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 really simple firewall administration, check out guffaw.
Right. Just one click access, enable and disable firewall. And that's it. One click and you're done. Very simple. I think it might take.
I'm not going to say too simple, but some might say that.
It might even take probably a couple more clicks to get the actual app open. It'll take more to open the app than it will to enable or disable the firewall. So,
that's pretty funny. All right. What's next?
Install the official Google Gadget. You were going to talk about Google Gadgets. What's that all about?
A little bit. Well, Google Gadgets, these are, Google calls them gadgets. Other things call them widgets and stuff. Little tiny little programs that can install on your desktop. And Google has now made them available for Linux as well as OS X. And I believe I must have just misplaced the bookmark, but I thought that they open sourced them as well. Yes, they did. Yep. They're not only just available, but the source code is available. And there is a repository over on Launchpad. So we can include a link in the show notes. But if you want, you can now install the official Google gadgets to get them on Ubuntu now.
There's a pretty simple tutorial on how to install them. And it's just adding a couple of repos and then a sudo apt-get install Google Gadgets. Pretty simple, pretty easy. And for those of you who are running, you know, OS X or even Vista, you have gadgets right there on your desktop right now. For instance, on my Vista machine, I have a clock and a calendar up and running all the time. And, in XP, they used to be called, or the company that used to do it was Confabulator, which was bought up by Yahoo.
Right.
And, and that kind of thing. So we're all kind of familiar with that kind of thing. And now it's finally, you can still get it in Linux right now. And I believe KDE has some sort of gadget type of thing on their user interface. And I think also GNOME has something like a screenlet application. So anyway, let's go on to the next news story, which is this coming Tuesday on June 17th, Firefox 3 will finally be released. Is that what I'm hearing or reading right now, Peter?
That's what I've read. Yep, the final version, the real official Firefox 3 is coming out next week. And I'm looking forward to it. I got to say, under Ubuntu, I haven't really had any problems, but it's been kind of buggy, kind of crashy on me under Windows. So I'm not sure if it's caused by extensions. I'm not running a lot of extensions, so I don't know what it is. But it seems to me there's still a little bit of work that needs doing. So I'm hoping that that stabilizes. But I'm looking forward to it. I've been fairly happy with the release candidates.
Yeah, after about the first week with Hardy Heron, it started getting a lot better. Hardy Heron came out and by default installed Firefox 3, which at the beginning kind of annoyed me, but has since gotten much, much better, and I've been using it exclusively on Hardy. I didn't bother to put Firefox 2 back on, and it's been doing just fine. There has been I haven't encountered any bugs for that matter, and except for the initial mild annoyance about not having my plugins work, everything has been just fine and dandy, and I'm actually looking forward to this one. I don't use it in Windows at all. I am still stuck with Firefox 2. I'm sticking with it for a while. Hopefully they've gotten all the memory leaks fixed and that kind of thing.
Yep.
You want to do the next one?
All right. Sure. Banshee 1.0 final is out. Banshee is that up-and-coming media player. I've used it very little myself, but a lot of folks have been, playing this up, and I'm pretty sure I saw some Brainstorm articles saying that, this should be the default media player for Ubuntu. It's got, features comparable to, say, iTunes. It's got a more powerful search engine now, they say. It has Last.fm integration. It also manages your videos, audio CDs, and supports MP3 and other audio players, so like iPod support and things like that. So definitely looks good. I'm going to check that out and see that if that's a good replacement for, for iTunes on Windows. Right now, it's only available for Linux distributions, but they say that Windows and OS X versions are coming soon as well.
That's great. I'm looking forward to that. Now, it says it has podcast support. Now, are you able, does it come with a list of podcasts that you can choose from? Wondering.
That I don't know. I did not check that out when I was running the older the test versions. I don't remember searching for podcasts. I was just going in and, punching in the RSS feeds that I already had.
That's what I was hoping to find, something like, what was it? G Potter used to have something like that. They would have a list of podcasts that you could choose from. And I don't know where they got it, whether it was from Podcast Alley or from podcast.net. But that was a really neat feature because it had all the podcasts right there in one place. You know what I mean? And you could just kind of click and choose and browse from hundreds of thousands of podcasts. So instead of having to search, you know, the internet or even import OPML files and that kind of thing. So, but I haven't given this a try yet. I know that there are a few people out there who posted it to our Delicious tag, Delicious account, and so I thought we ought to mention something about it. So, yeah,
cool. While we're on the topic of software releases, Wine 1.0 release candidate, the final release candidate, is due out this Friday, which will be probably by the time you're listening to this. So we're still not sure exactly what the final release will be, but RC5 is coming out, you know, like probably by the time you're hearing this.
Yeah, I just recently put the repositories for Wine on my Ubuntu Hardy installation, and so I'm now getting the latest release. I don't think I've gotten the RCs yet or the release candidates in there, but we need to get one of the Wine guys on here, don't you think?
I think we should. I think we should either someone from, you know, the Wine HQ or from Code Weavers, or if not that, maybe somebody from the Ubuntu Wine team.
That'd be cool. We can talk about Wine and why there is a need for it, and you know, what we can hope to encounter in the future. So we'll try and work on that. So Gnome Do, cool. You use this application?
Yeah, I do. I do it. I generally use it for launching some apps. I'm, after reading up about the latest version though, 0.5. I know I'm not doing nearly as much with it as I could. It's a pretty neat little application launcher, and as of version 0.5, I guess the author calls it the fighting 0.5. he says the biggest new feature is a new preferences window and a plugin manager, so you can browse, download, install, and enable or disable plugins. And I said, okay, that's kind of cool. And you know, they've got a wiki to talk about all the different plugins that are available. So I'm not an expert on these. I don't have, like, I haven't installed any plugins for my copy of Gnome Do, so I don't know anything about those, but it's definitely a lot more powerful than I thought. I mean, they show some examples and, how you can, like, start a Skype call from Gnome. I would never, or from Gnome Do, I wouldn't have thought about doing that, you know? And so they've got some, it looks pretty cool. They've got a Twitter interface, Pigeon interface, Facebook, Flickr, all kinds of stuff. So looks like a pretty slick little application launcher. Again, this is sort of like the answer to Quicksilver, for instance. And speaking of Quicksilver, that's kind of interesting. Remember that they open sourced that a while back, but I haven't heard of anybody getting it running on any platforms, you know, any new platforms yet.
Yeah, neither have I.
I thought we would have seen that by now.
In one of the navigation things up here, it has Quicksilver and Gnome Do right there on the page up on top.
Yeah, oh, do they?
They have a little. Excuse me. We have a little blog post about Quicksilver and Gnome Do. So anyway, you might want to take a look at that also. But yeah, I have this running on my machine, and I just use it to open up applications, packages, and that kind of thing. But it does look a lot more feature filled than what I'm using, and so I'll look into that. That's kind of cool. Starting up a Skype call and that kind of. That is that's pretty neat.
Yep. Yeah. Looks pretty slick.
Ubuntu EEE.
All right.
Going gold.
Yep. Almost ready. The version of Ubuntu, you know, tailored straight towards EEE PCs is it's gold. So it's almost, you know, ready. It's it's kind of funny. The blog post on June 2nd, release candidate, it says, as soon as this has been tried out for a few days, Ubuntu EEE 8.04 is released. Try it today. And then try it today is struck out, and it says, didn't work at all. you got to love wikis.
That was about 7 days ago. Before the next one. Before the next update, yeah.
Yes.
So.
Yes, I thought that was classic. Try it today. Didn't work at all. Like, scratch that.
But it is, it looks like it may be customized. Oh, it'll be customized for the small screen and use the Netbook Remix interface. So, great. Wonderful.
So, pretty slick.
So,
All right.
Go ahead.
Any well, you just mentioned yep. Netbook, and Mark Shuttleworth blogged about that and talking about the Canonical OEM team and how they have been approached by a number of OEMs who want to sell netbooks based on Ubuntu. So I was excited to hear about that, about you know, interest in the netbook remix is and Ubuntu itself is being picked up. So I thought that was a really good sign.
Cool.
Yeah, I've actually I followed the links that he gave in this blog post, which we'll have in the show notes, to install the PPA, you know, to test it out on one of my virtual machines. And it was, you know, initially it was kind of cool, but I've tried changing my screen resolutions and, you know, shrinking it down so that it would be more like what you would see on an actual netbook. And after I fiddled with that, I was never actually able to get it working again. So kind of embarrassing. So it needs a little more work, or I need a little more work or something. But it looks really cool, and I think that it's going to be, you know, a neat little way to navigate. But there are some times I was feeling myself, you know, like, I really wish I had my desktop back, you know. So it takes some getting used to. But if you've got really limited resources, I think it's going to end up being a pretty cool
now,
thing.
Now, is there any way to change the interface, or do you have to stick with this everything all on the screen?
You got me. I didn't use it long enough to actually start changing anything, so I really don't know. All I did is I tried to, you know, I installed it first in a virtual machine whose screen resolution was like 1440 by 900, and then I said, well, let me just change this down to 800 by 480, you know, which is a pretty standard resolution for a small netbook. And as soon as I did that, the fonts just did not scale right, so they were tiny, tiny, tiny. I couldn't read a thing. And I tried a few times to, you know, reinstall and reconfigure the packages. I couldn't quite get it, but I didn't spend a lot of time on it. And, you know, I'm sure if I did, I could have found a workaround. But, you know, like I said, it looks kind of cool. I'm not sure if I would want to be running it full time, all, you know, on a full screen desktop, but it might be, you know, pretty neat for a little notebook.
Sounds really good. If I had a UMPC, I'd try to put it on there. Actually, I do have one, but Ubuntu won't run on it, so it's too bad.
Sigh.
Buy another one.
Well, does that do it for the... Yeah, I guess so.
That does it for the news.
Does that wrap up the news?
Rounds out the news.
Okay. That's the news. But I had a question,
what?
Harlem. I have a question for you. If you were Richard Stallman and you wanted to order pizza, what would you do?
That's a good question, Peter, and I'm glad you asked. Because on YouTube right now, there is a script, and they made a video of this, where you can order pizza on the command line.
I thought that was pretty funny. I saw that. It's not new. It's been around for a while, but you know, it turned up again in Dig or somewhere, and as soon as I saw it, I just had to post it. Well, with the whole man page minute stuff that we do. But yeah, it's basically someone wrote a little script, which I guess, you know, just is like a screen scraper or connects to Domino's Pizza's API somehow. And basically lets you order pizza from, you know, from a command prompt.
Pretty
so
neat.
I thought that was pretty funny. And it goes to answer the question, what would Stallman do, you know, if he was ordering pizza?
You know, after what a late night of coding, you're sitting around and you got some munchies, you just, what do you do, right?
What do you do? You order pizza.
That's right.
There you go.
Well, that's going to do it for the news and our little segment, What Would Richard Stallman Do? But we have coming up next is an interview that Peter did with Brian Murray, the Bug Master. And we have that coming up right now.
And joining us today on the line is Brian Murray, known as the Bug Master from the Ubuntu community. Brian, how are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me here.
Great. We're glad you could join us. Brian, if you could first start by telling us a little bit about yourself, maybe what exactly your role is in the Ubuntu community and how you got to be there.
So my role is helping to ensure that we have high quality bug reports about the Ubuntu distribution. This involves gathering debugging material about specific packages, applications, and subsystems, and then making that information usable for bug reporters and bug triagers. We have a large community of bug triagers known as the Bug Squad, and so we want to make it possible for them to learn more about a specific application or subsystem and then engage in a dialogue with bug reporters to gather that information so the bug is in a usable format for the developers to work on either fixing the bug or implementing a particular feature in Ubuntu.
So how can you give us an example, a bug reporter? I'm assuming that's anybody who reports a bug, and a bug, what'd you say, a bug squasher, smasher? What's their role exactly? Is that like a package maintainer, or is this a separate person?
One analogy would be to technical support. So somebody has reported a bug and says that a specific feature of an application doesn't work. But for the developer to be able to recreate the bug or to be able to start working on the bug, it's possible for that application that we would need specific log files or specific steps to reproduce the bug and information about the bug reporter's environment. So that's where the bug squad comes in. We've written various documentation about how to gather that information or what information to gather depending on what the package is. So then in the event that the bug reporter didn't include that information in their initial bug report, the bug squad will help gather that information. Bugs are initially reported in a new status, and there's about 9 different statuses in Launchpad for tracking bug reports. And the initial part of the bug lifecycle is moving a bug report from new to the confirmed or triage state. And those are the bugs that a developer would look at. So the bug squad is instrumental in moving the bugs from this new status to the confirmed or triage status and also assigning priorities to bug reports.
Okay, interesting. Curious, just for kicks, can you tell us what are the 9 9 states of a bug? Because we use a bug tracking or a ticketing system here at work, but we only have 4.
So initially a bug is reported as new. The bug can become incomplete in the event that there isn't enough information. A bug report can move to confirmed when either all that information has been gathered or a second person has recreated the bug report. And then from there, there's an access-controlled bug status called triaged, which there's a team who can set that state. And then from there, there's in progress, which indicates that the bug is being worked on. Fix committed means that the fix is available somewhere, but not necessarily downloadable as a package yet. So, for example, there's the hyphen proposed repository, which is where proposed fixes for a released version of Ubuntu Go. So that's the fix committed state. And then there's fix released, meaning that the fix is available to every Ubuntu user. Additionally, there's the invalid status. Perhaps the bug reporter never gave sufficient information in a timely fashion for the bug to be confirmed, in which case it could move to invalid. Or if it was just a configuration issue, the bug could move to invalid. Then we also have won't fix, meaning that the feature that won't be implemented in the particular piece of software. So that should be all 9.
Okay, very cool. Just a piece of trivia question, don't want to divert too much, but what is the status of bug number 1 at this time?
I believe it's in progress.
Okay, good. I just checking on that. If you want to know what that is, listeners, just go over to Launchpad and check out the bugs. We'll put a link in the show notes. So, Brian, how did you get to be, you've been dubbed the bug master by, I think, George Castro. How did you get to that status? And are you a Canonical employee or are you a volunteer?
Yes, I'm an employee of Canonical. Canonical has a few employees working specifically on bug triage and bug work for different parts of the distribution. And I've been working for Canonical for almost a year and a half now, and I started off as the one of two QA people, and we were both responsible for working with bug reports and helping to develop this debugging documentation and leading the bug squad and the Ubuntu bug control teams.
Cool. All right. So tell us then, now I'm an average ordinary user here. I've got Ubuntu loaded on my system and I encounter a problem with my software or problem with Ubuntu or one of the apps that comes with Ubuntu. How do I decide if it's a bug? And then if I do decide that, you know, this is a bug, I got to tell somebody about it. Tell us exactly how you do that. Walk us through the steps, how one goes and reports a bug.
So a bug in a piece of Ubuntu software would be the application behaving not in the way that it's advertised. So the application just doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Or perhaps the application doesn't behave in the way that you expected or the way that you think it should. An Ubuntu application isn't going to feed your dog, but perhaps an application could be improved by adding a new feature. That's a legitimate bug. So to recap, an application may not behave the way it's advertised. It may not behave the way you expected, or it might not have a feature that you want. So those are three general possible types of bug reports. And then I believe you also asked about how to report a bug about Ubuntu. We use Launchpad as our bug tracking system, and that's where we keep track of all our bug reports. However, there's also functionality built into several applications within the Ubuntu distribution. For example, if you have Firefox open now, if you were to go to the Help menu, there's a Report a Problem option right there. And what that'll do is it'll launch an application called Apport, which will automatically gather debugging information about that particular package and which version you have installed, which release of Ubuntu you're running, what kernel you happen to be running, and that information will be automatically attached to your bug report when you report it to Launchpad. So because Apport does a lot of work for you, that's the preferred method for reporting a bug about a specific application.
Okay. And is that fairly... It's fairly self-explanatory then to the novice user. It's going to ask them for, you know, all the relevant information that you would want. So it pretty much streamlines the process. So
it'll automatically gather a lot of the information. And then when you actually go to the report, so it'll attach, add attachments and some information to your description of the bug report in Launchpad. When you're reporting a bug in Launchpad, you're asked for a title or a summary of the bug report, and then also you're presented with a dialog box to enter an initial description of the bug report. Mm-hmm. And also at the same time, you can add attachments, which would be supporting documentation for your bug report.
Okay, cool. So I guess basically then, anytime somebody finds a bug, is it should they just start reporting it, or is there anything they should do before they submit a bug report?
Ideally, the bug reporter would do some due diligence and do some research to find out whether or not the bug has already been reported about the Ubuntu distribution. So, for example, if you have a bug with Firefox 3.0, it would be great if you could go and look and see if those... your particular bug has already been reported about Firefox, and then add information, if you have some useful information to provide about that particular bug, to the bug report, or you can subscribe to the bug report and then receive email updates as to the progress of the bug as developers are working on it.
Okay, so
However, there are a few bug reports about Firefox, so it can be challenging to find the bug report. And in the event that you can't find it and want to submit a new bug report, that's absolutely fine. And then one of the other responsibilities of Bug Squad is to help find duplicates. So perhaps there's a Bug Squad member who's really familiar with Firefox, so they might have already heard of your bug report and would mark your bug as a duplicate of the one that was already in Launchpad.
Okay. I was going to ask how you handled duplicates and stuff, whether you like merge them in or you just say that, you know, it's already been reported. So if you do something like that, if you mark a bug as a duplicate, does the person who reported the duplicate copy get notifications for the original?
Yes, they become a subscriber of the original bug report, and then they will get notifications about what is happening in the original bug report. And it's best that if there's any conversation about the bug, it's best that that take place in the original bug report.
Right. Okay. Excellent. So tell us a little bit, what is, let's assume then before we move on, let's say I submit a bug and I find a bug with, let's see your example, Firefox. And does the bug team going to try to fix a bug with Firefox? Do they then, you know, submit an upstream patch, or do they just notify Mozilla and take it from there? How does that work?
Firefox is an interesting example. There, we have a large patch set for that specific application. So it's possible that the bug exists in our release of Firefox and not upstream. So then an additional thing that the Bug Squad would do is test it with the upstream version of Firefox and see whether or not it's possible to recreate the bug with that version. In the event that it was, we would forward the bug to the developers of the software, and Launchpad has the ability to watch an upstream bug report so we can monitor the status of it and see what is happening there. However, with a lot of applications, our goal is for the package just to be synced. So with a lot of applications, we sync directly from Debian. So if the bug exists in the Ubuntu version of the package, it also exists in the Debian one, in which case we would create that relationship between the bug reports.
Okay. So you're basically dependent on the Debian team fixing the package at that point then?
No, not at all. A lot of Ubuntu developers are also Debian developers. So it's possible they would end up fixing the bug report upstream, and then the next time a sync was done on that package, then the fix would be pulled into Ubuntu.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Now what if the problem is not with Firefox? You mentioned the help report a bug tool. Is that something you could still use for non-Firefox bugs, or is there a different package program for that? Is that a different bug reporting tool?
So lots of applications on the Ubuntu desktop have this help report a problem menu item. GNOME Terminal, for example, also has it. However, this becomes an issue with some things like the kernel. You know, there isn't a help menu for the kernel, and there's not a help menu for Xorg. So for reporting those bugs, AppPort also has a command line interface, if you want to use that, where it would gather the same information we were talking about, the specific package version, what release of Ubuntu you're running, and add that to the bug report. Alternatively, you're absolutely welcome to file a bug report directly in Launchpad.
Okay. And so is that a matter of you just go to launchpad.net and follow the prompts there to submit a bug, or is there any specific procedure that is it really obvious to a new user?
Yes, it's fairly obvious. You have to sign up for a user account. And then you would want to file a bug about the Launchpad hosts a lot of projects, not just Ubuntu. So you would want to file a bug about the Ubuntu distribution. And then one dialogue that sometimes becomes confusing is identifying a source package. When your system boots up, you're presented with an Ubuntu logo, and there's that throbber during the boot process. So that application is, how do you know what the package name for that is? We have some documentation at wiki.ubuntu.com. I think it's /find-write-package. And that has information about how to determine what the package name is when you're reporting a bug in Launchpad. And the particular application I was talking about is called USplash. But it also has information about what package to use for the kernel, what package to use for X, which is your display environment. And frequently, we seem to get a lot of bug reports where the bug doesn't have a package. Currently, we have about 3,000 of those bug reports outstanding. And those bug reports aren't looked at regularly. And they're definitely not looked at by the Firefox maintainer. They're not looked at by the X maintainer. So it's really critical that when you're reporting a bug about an application, that you include the source package name. And that's why it's particularly useful to go to the Help Report a Problem menu item. That way that information is gathered for you automatically.
Okay. So, for instance, the issue that I had a few weeks ago when I was discussing it with Alan was where my system basically would not boot. It was hanging somewhere, where I was trying to mount my RAID arrays. That's somewhere where I would have to submit that. I don't have a help report a bug there at the boot screen.
Right.
So, right. Okay. All right. So,
and also
go ahead.
There's members of the Ubuntu Bug Squad available on IRC, on the Freenode server and the Ubuntu Bugs channel.
Okay.
And they're more than happy to help people find the right package when reporting a bug or gather the correct debugging information.
Okay. And that's Ubuntu-help, is it? Or Ubuntu-bugs or just Ubuntu bugs?
Ubuntu-bugs.
Bugs. Okay. So we can link to that too. All right. My next question is, tell us about this thing, five a day. What's that all about?
So similar to how you want to get so many items of a specific food group per day, some people started up the five a day project where the goal of Bug Squad members or developers is to work on five bugs a day. And when I say work on, that doesn't mean fix the bug report. It actually means help to improve a bug report. So earlier I mentioned the confirmed bug status. Any Launchpad user can set a bug to confirmed. So your five a day could be as simple as looking at five new bug reports about Ubuntu and trying to confirm them. So if you're able to recreate the bug report, go ahead and make the bug report more complete by putting the exact steps you use to recreate the problem and set the status to confirmed, and that would be one of your five a day. And then, so the five a day program, it's actually an application where you can record your five, the five bugs that you've touched in a specific day, and then you can look at how many you've worked on compared to other five a day members, and then also you can participate in the five a day program as a member of a team. So, for example, I think the Ubuntu Chicago Loco team has a five-a-day team, and they do a fair bit of bug work, and you can see how the Chicago five-a-day team is doing compared to the German five-a-day team, let's say.
Okay. All right. So that's something just for people who are on the bug teams, not necessarily for end users then?
Well, as I mentioned, any end user can become a bug triager. It's a trivial process. To mark a bug as confirmed, that's something anybody can do.
Okay.
So you could join the five-a-day team and participate in the five-a-day process and help to make Ubuntu better just by moving bug reports along in the life cycle, by moving bugs from new to confirmed, if you can, in fact, recreate the bug.
Gotcha.
Or by starting a dialogue with bug reporters to gather more information.
Okay.
There's no real barrier to entry to becoming the member of the Bug Squad and helping to make bug reports more complete.
Okay, that makes sense. Good. All right, so that's five a day. What about this thing we read about last week, Bug Jam? Can you give us any insight on that?
So one thing that the Bug Squad does regularly is we hold Ubuntu Bug Days, and that's where we have a list of bugs that we want to target about a specific application or a specific type of bug. For example, today we're looking at CompIS bug reports, and CompIS provides the extra visual effects on your Ubuntu desktop. So we're looking at those new bug reports and trying to gather more information about the bugs and moving bugs to incomplete or confirmed to make them ready for developers to work on, and also trying to find any really high priority ones that need to be fixed right away. As an extension of this, some Loco teams have started holding bug jams. And that's where a group of people physically get together and work on improving Ubuntu by making bug reports more complete and moving bug reports along in the workflow. It's a fun activity where people can work together and build a knowledge base about a specific application and help to improve the debugging documentation for that application and help to make Ubuntu better. So as an extension of the Loco one, we're going to have a global bug jam where everybody's going to get together and work on specific bug lists. So I'll be creating bug lists for teams to pick from. If there's a team interested in OpenOffice, they can look at these OpenOffice bug reports. And then on that specific day, we'll be gathering in real life and online to work on improving Ubuntu and also working with upstreams to establish the relationship between bug reports in Launchpad and whatever the upstream bug tracker uses.
Okay. And that's something, if someone wants, hears about this bug jam thing and wants to participate, should they, what, contact their nearest loco? Or what's like an end user supposed to do if they want to jump in?
Right, absolutely. Contact their loco. Or in the event that there isn't one in your area, there'll be members of the Bug Squad available on the Ubuntu Bugs IRC channel. And we'll have some other lists available for individual people if there's bugs that they want to look at or work on.
Terrific. Well, Brian, I think that's all the questions that I have for you today. Is there anything else that you'd like to say? Anything to potential bug reporters or bug jammers? Any messages you want to get out to them?
I think at one point in time, you asked about minimum requirements for a bug report.
Mm-hmm.
Like what is the ideal information that we want to see in a bug report?
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely vital that we know what release of Ubuntu a bug reporter is reporting the bug about. We have four different releases out in the wild now that are supported. There's Dapper, Feisty, Gutsy, and Hardy. So when we look at a bug report in Launchpad, if you don't tell us which release of Ubuntu you're running, we don't have a way of knowing. Subsequently, it can be challenging to recreate the bug in every release or find out which release the bug pertains to. Additionally, it's important to know which specific package version that you're experiencing the bug report with. Particularly when if somebody's running a development release of Ubuntu, if anybody's running Intrepid now, there's a lot of changes to the package versions. So it's important to know, did you experience this with last week's version of the package? Perhaps that bug already got fixed.
Okay. All right.
So we have the release, the package version, and then also the bug report should be as detailed as possible. Not every member of the Bug Squad is intimately familiar with every single feature of OpenOffice. So if you can put as many details as possible in the bug report and make it more complete, it'll make it easier for somebody to confirm that bug report.
Terrific. All right. I guess that's all we have for you today. So I want to just say thanks again for joining us. And if there's any listeners who've been curious on how to go about reporting bugs, now we know. No excuses. So get out there and, I'm not going to ask all of our listeners to do five a day, but, maybe one. Brian,
yeah, one would be great.
Great. Brian Murray, the Bugmaster from Canonical. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Let me take a moment to introduce our next segment, which is the Man Page Minute, the Cafe Ninja kindly sent to us. It is on the command cut, and we'll take it away from here. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back shortly after the Man Page Minute.
This week's Man Page Minute is on the command cut. In for Peter Nicolaitis, I'm Emmett Stewart, a.k.a. Cafe Ninja. To use the command, you need to, practice a lot. If you ask the man page, it's cut options file. Cut will show you some data from a text file in a columnar way to think about it. That is to say that if you ask cut to show you limited results from a text file based on a view of the file from top down. From top down, I mean like a column of a spreadsheet. From practice, I can say this would work best with trying to just get a list of content from a specific column from a CSV. But we'll work on any text file. The switches for cut are complex. You can define the delimiter used in the file, which column to show, which characters per line to show, never mind the delimiter. There are many, many more. You can look into these depending on your needs or the information you need to have shown from the file. If you had a CSV and wanted to see just the contents of the second column, you would give the command cut minus D double quote comma double quote space minus F2 file.csv. That would show you every line, second column of your file.csv. That's it for this week's Man Page Minute. This is Cafe Ninja signing off.
All right. Thanks for the Man Page Minute, Cafe Ninja. He was very kind enough to do that on the cut command. And I hope you learned a lot from that. And I certainly did. I always learn a lot from these Man Page Minutes and really appreciate Peter's work and Cafe Ninja's work. And I hope somebody's getting a lot out of it, too. So we are not.
Yeah, I got to admit, I've never used the cut
never.
Command.
Huh.
Never. That's something I would have done like with awk or something like that.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I learned something.
Cool. Well, we got some feedback this week. What you got some?
Good. Oh yeah. Yeah, we got feedback.
And also got a rant from Randy too, by the way.
Oh, of course we did. Wouldn't be complete without that. I got a tweet from on Twitter from Gookin, and he said, "I don't know if you have mentioned this, but could you explain how Wine works and how to use it?" And I did reply to him because I know, Harlem, you did a Wine episode a while back, and I think you got, Quicken running under it. I don't remember exactly. It was either Quicken or Microsoft Money or something.
I tried to get Quicken running, and most all of the features worked, but there were a couple of things that didn't. So by now, I haven't touched it since then, so we should do another episode.
Yeah, well, what we'll maybe try to do is, like we were talking about, maybe try to get one of the Wine developers or, you know, someone more involved with the Wine project involved and see if we can get some, you know, info straight from the horse's
absolutely.
Mouth there, you know?
Yeah, perfect. So, I got this email from Bill De La Vega that he writes, "I like your podcast. It's great that you guys share your experiences. Thanks much. I've recently installed 64-bit Gutsy and upgraded to Hardy. Probably used Ubuntu for about 10 to 15 hours total, but have also used SUSE, Fedora, Debian, and FreeBSD in the past. Non-computing comment. I heard one of the British guys comment about Svelte on the label of the beer he was drinking. I spent 13, or this gentleman, Bill, spent 13 months working in Russia where a couple of developers used Ubuntu. And he said he drank a rather large number of bottles of beer from kiosks. If the beer was Czech or Russian or probably several other languages, Svetli just means light, as in not a dark beer." So there you go.
Didn't we cover that last week?
No.
It sounds awfully familiar.
Man. No, we didn't do any user feedback.
Either that or we have a lot of people talking
about. We didn't do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I seem to remember you talking about Svelte before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
If I did.
I don't know. Hey, it's beer. We can talk about beer. Why not?
Okay.
All right. Next feedback I got was from a gent named Buddy. And the really quick email was, "What's the story on Ubuntu dropping the Power PC?" Well, Buddy, I guess we would have to call that old news at this point. Ubuntu dropped the PowerPC support a while back. I don't even remember. Was there Dapper for PowerPC?
I think Dapper might have been the last one.
Might have been. It's been a while. But basically, you know, it's not as powerful, not as popular a platform as it was once, once Macintosh moved off of it, then I would expect that, you know, the demand kind of dropped, and it's not as easy to get a PowerPC box now as it was then, at least not a new one. So I guess I would just have to say that, you know, it's probably just lack of demand for it caused that. But there's plenty of other Linux distributions out there that will still run on PowerPC, like just, you know, stock Debian. I installed that on my old PowerBook G4, and it installed very easily. I was quite surprised because I had read about all kinds of, you know, things, tips and tricks that you needed to do just to get, you know, Debian installed, and then all kinds of things that you had to do to get, you know, Linux installed on a Mac. And it really, really automated a lot of that. So it was not nearly as painful as I expected it to be.
Yeah. Are they even still making that chip anymore?
Yes, the PowerPC chip still exists, definitely. It's I'm pretty sure, isn't that used in the Xbox?
It might be. I don't have an Xbox.
Yeah. But. I think the Xbox is a multiprocessor PowerPC.
Well,
so, yeah, it's definitely still alive. It's just not, you know, not for like desktop PCs now.
Well, once Apple stopped using that platform, I think that interest waned after that. So, anyway, next one is from James. He said, recently you complained, or I complained, of being unable to boot your PC using 8.04 and having to revert to an old kernel. Wait a minute. That was you.
That was me. I complained. Uh-huh.
And have had this problem for such a long time, and no one has ever mentioned getting a fix for it. I have two bug reports that try to detail the problem, and they are, he gives a link here, created on last year, June 14th, 2007. And there was another one on April 14th, 2007. So he's got a couple of bugs out. And he's yet to upgrade to 8.04. He's going to ensure that he keeps 7.10 installation until he's totally sure 8.04 works. He hopes that our interest, or at least Peter's interest, in this bug, there will be a resolution soon, and look forward to hearing the progress on your podcast. Cheers, James. So, Peter, I haven't had a chance to look at these bugs, you know, 8.04 booted just fine. Is it still working on yours, or is it not?
Yeah, I haven't. I've still got to dig that server. Basically, because of this problem, we ended up actually just replacing it. We bought a Buffalo Terra station, so that it, you know, the box was kind of old. It was due for retirement anyway. So I've got to really dig back down. But that might be a good, you know, bug jam five a day kind of thing for me to do, is to see. I don't know that the error messages that are reported in his don't seem to be the same. It's similar, you know, where like boot process doesn't work and doesn't boot all the way, but it does not appear to be the same thing from as same problem that I was having, although it does look very similar. But this is an example, though, where if there's anyone else can help and you know, has any info, then it might be great if, you know, someone could chime in, especially if you have anything else to contribute.
So that is going to do it. I think we have one last message here, and this is from our good friend, Randy. And Randy sent us another web call button email or voicemail, which, by the way, you can also go do yourself. All you have to do is go straight to freshubuntu.org, and in the right-hand column, there's this big, 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 big old graphic, and it says, call me. Go ahead and click that graphic and enter your phone number, and you can send us a voicemail from your phone. Here is the voicemail that we got from Randy. It's one of his Randy's rants, and he's talking about Obama again. So, 1 second, as I pull that up.
Hey, Harlan and Peter, it's Randy out here. Anyway, just was reading this Randy's rant or rave, if I say that right. Randy's rant or what rave, RRR, RRR. Anyway, I was just in a reading about how Obama, Senator Obama, or is trying to put, or wants to put open office in federal offices, which, in the big scheme of things, you know, okay, the OLPC has lost to XP, which, you know, the OLPC has kind of been struggling anyway. Open office in federal government in the United States, OLPC, it's got XP on it and it's got open office, who really cares? They're already getting in, you know, the whole method of getting people into the open source community or into the open source goodness is, you know, Firefox, OpenOffice. Thunderbird or another Mozilla derivative or something of that nature. And it's not that hard to slide XP out from underneath and put Linux in its place because people are using the applications. Desktop's almost irrelevant. So I think, All right, guys, have a good one. Talk to you later.
All right, thanks, Randy, for sending that to us. And of course, you can also do the same. And we can even guarantee that you will be on the show. So,
yeah. Now, I wanted to talk about that for a sec. I caught that Chad Wallenberg from over at Linux Basement posted that on Twitter. And my first reaction was, wow, that's, you know, that's pretty cool. The thing is, though, I still did not find any definitive source saying that Obama wants to put OpenOffice in all federal, you know, government offices. I found it on a blog, on a PC World blog. So basically some PC World correspondent's blogger, some PC World correspondent on his or her blog said Obama will put OpenOffice in all federal government offices. So, you know, if it's true, then, you know, that's great. But first off, I haven't seen any real evidence that he did say that. And, you know, I know that he has a history of using and supporting open source software, and that's all well and good. I mean, the fact that he just understands it is good. But I'd like to see a little more, you know, something to make this official. And frankly, unfortunately, even then, if we do see that, it's still just a campaign promise until it happens. But, you know, so I just wanted to throw that in, just take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, we can always hope.
And exactly. The more use of open source software, I think all around the better. Cost saving and, I don't know, just all around better, I guess. I've been using open source software for a couple of years now. And I got to tell you, you can't beat it. So, anywho, that's going to cut it for us this week. So, I know it's a beautiful day outside. I'm going to try and get outside and get some yard work done. And the kids are out of school.
Yep.
And so on my day off, they're running around and driving me a little bit crazy. And it'll take me about a couple of weeks to get used to everybody being home. But it'll certainly drive my wife crazy. So anyway.
Well, because of all the snow days we have this winter, school's been extended out, so we've got another week of classes.
How lucky for you.
Yeah, that's great. Except that means at the end of the day is when the kid wants to go down to the river and hang out down there all the time. So on that note, I should get home so that I can, you know, take him for a dunk.
All right, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks, Peter, for getting that interview put together. We're going to try and get a wine developer sometime in the near future. And thank you once again to Brian Murray and also to Cafe Ninja, Emmett Stewart, a.k.a. Emmett Stewart, for getting the Man Page Minute out here. That's going to do it for this week. Again, our emails are peter@freshubuntu.org, harlem@freshubuntu.org, and the location of the companion website is freshubuntu.org. That's going to do it for this week, and hope to talk to you again next week. Bye-bye now.